Chapter 30, An Important Anniversary and a Typist's Nightmare. Thursday, the 24th of February, was a rather full day, though perhaps no more full than were most other days at the time. In the afternoon, Francoise, having been given her work and visitors dealt with, Terry and I drove to Mildmay Hospital to see Alf Vile's 14-year-old son, who had had his tonsils out and was still recovering. My own tonsils had been removed when I was 6, and remembering the unpleasantness of my stay in hospital on that occasion, I could sympathise with the boy. Alf was already there, and after the three of us had spent half an hour with David, and I had given him a big picture of a Buddha image and a bundle of incense sticks — he regarded himself as a Buddhist — the most vocal of the three musketeers took us to his flat in nearby Bethnal Green, where we had tea with him and his wife and his daughter Christine, who was already known to me as a member of the speakers' class. I had not been in the East End before, and little suspected that one day I would be very familiar with Bethnal Green, and that it would occupy an important place in my history. From Bethnal Green, Terry and I drove to Red Lion Square, Holborn, and to Conway Hall, where we attended a meeting of the Personalist Group and heard a lecture by Dr. E. Graham Howe, a psychiatrist whom I had met a year earlier, author of The Invisible Anatomy, and founder of the Open Way Venture, who was an old friend of the Buddhist Society. The lecture was followed by discussion, after which my friend and I made our way up to West Hampstead, where, by way of celebration, we had a meal at the Indo-Pakistan restaurant. We were celebrating because the 24th of February was an anniversary. It was the anniversary of the day on which he and I first saw each other. This had been when Terry happened to attend, and I happened to be chairing, a talk by Mangalo on Buddhist meditation. The talk was given at the College of Psychic Science, South Kensington, where 2 months later I gave my lecture on Buddhism and the Problem of Death, and where, after the lecture, Terry came up to me and told me he had seen the pure white light. Since then, a lot had happened, culminating in Terry's giving up his job at the end of the year, after moving to the bigger, brighter flat in Lancaster Grove, where much of our time together was now spent. Believing as we did that the moods of depression to which he was subject were due partly to the nature of his job, we had assumed, perhaps naively, that once he stopped working and was free to study and meditate, there would be an improvement in his condition. But this proved not to be the case. In the new year, he became more depressed than ever, so that years afterwards, when I reflected on this development, I was led to wonder if his having to hold down a job he loathed, besides being a cause of his depression, had not also sometimes been the means of his keeping the blacker moods of it at bay. He also started having nightmares, from which he awoke sweating and trembling and in need of reassurance, so that I had to stay overnight at the other vihara more frequently than I might otherwise have done. Some of the nightmares were not only horrific, but bizarre. In one of them, he was a baked bean, trapped inside a Heinz tin with hundreds of other beans. Happily, it was not a state of affairs that lasted. After a couple of weeks, the nightmares ceased, and with them the moods of depression from which, as I had soon learned, Terry periodically suffered. For the remainder of the month, and for the whole of February and March, he in fact was more consistently cheerful than I had ever known him to be, or than he was ever to be again. During that period, I did not have to write in my diary, as I had had to write so often before, "Terry a little low," or "Terry depressed," or "Terry upset." Thus, there was a welcome respite, and although it was Terry who had been suffering from the moods of depression, it was almost as much a respite for me as for him. Having to spend time talking him out of these moods had on occasion been something of a strain, especially when I also had people to see, lectures to prepare and give, correspondence to deal with, and the affairs of the Vihara and the Sangha Association to oversee and to direct, all of which made heavy demands, not only on my time, but on my energy. The situation was made more difficult by the fact that Terry was obsessively anxious that no one should know he suffered from depression, or indeed suspect that he was anything other than the positive and well-adjusted, if rather reserved, young man he appeared to be. This meant that I was never able to talk freely to anyone about him, and had to make excuses for him when he was too depressed to turn up for a lecture or class as expected. But now those days were over, at least for the time being. Terry was able to devote his morning hours to study and meditation as originally planned. I no longer had to spend time talking him out of his moods of depression or make excuses for his non-appearance. Our friendship blossomed anew, and we fell into a routine that lasted, with few interruptions, until April came, and with it the Easter meditation retreat at Biddulph. The routine varied a little according to whether or not I had spent the night at the flat. If I had spent the night there, Terry and I would meditate together, after which I would spend the rest of the morning working on my next lecture, while he studied and made notes, and then go back to the Bihara after lunch. Otherwise, I would try to be at the flat for part of the evening, and we would talk and listen to music. On some days, Terry would come round to the Vihara early and join Eric and me, and later Chien Chow and Robert, the new postulant, as well, for our morning puja and meditation and for breakfast. Thus, my time was usually divided during those months of welcome respite between the Vihara and the flat, between periods of external activity and shorter periods of withdrawal, reflection, and deeper communication. It was divided, in other words, between the two places that had come to embody, respectively, the public and the private, the lower and the higher, monasteries or hermitages of my dreams. Sometimes Terry and I would spend the afternoon in town, either visiting the bookshops or seeing a film. So far as I remember, we never visited the National Gallery or any other of London's great art collections, probably because Terry had little interest in the visual arts for their own sake. He did, however, have a favourite painting, or perhaps I should say there was one painting he liked, and of which he possessed a postcard. This was the work by Bronzino, known as An Allegory, or alternatively as An Allegory of Time and Love. With its smooth, marmoreal bodies, its predominance of cold whites and blues, its touches of rose and pale green, and its enigmatic meaning. Despite his lack of interest in the visual arts, Terry was happy to photograph a small soapstone Buddha image for the Sangha Association's Wesak card, as well as to design the card and get it printed, a task that took up more of his time and energy than either of us had expected. There were also visits to the provincial Buddhist groups. Some of these visits involved an evening meditation class or lecture. And one of my most vivid memories of that whole period is of Terry and me driving down the eerily deserted motorway afterwards and my watching, fascinated, as the long rows of overhead sodium lights in front of us appeared to twist and turn with every turning of the road and every change of altitude. At such times, I experienced a deep sense of contentment with myself, with my surroundings, and with the work I had just done. The only thing that disrupted Terry's cheerfulness was his fortnightly visits to Ilford, when he took Fiona there for the weekend. Though these sojourns under the parental roof with his harsh, tyrannical father and hypochondriacal mother continued to be a trial to him, they affected him much less badly than before, and he recovered from them much more quickly. This was all the more remarkable in that his parents now had, as they thought, more cause for complaint than ever. Not only was it no longer possible for them to conceal from friends and neighbours the shameful fact of the breakdown of their son's marriage, they now had to come to terms with the no less shameful fact that he had given up his well-paid job in order to study philosophy, whatever that might be, and that sooner or later friends and neighbours would have to be informed of this too. From what Terry told me, I gathered his parents were as little able to understand his giving up his job as they were of understanding his desire to study philosophy. He dared not say anything about studying Buddhism. The only explanation they could think of, apparently, was that his interest in philosophy had affected his brain, and that it was because his brain was affected that he had given up his job. Now that he was studying philosophy full-time, he was bound to get worse. Terry did indeed get worse, though not in the sense they meant, and his getting worse was certainly not due to philosophy. The immediate cause was the decisive change that took place in his relations with Gillian, a change for which Gillian herself was responsible. The change related not to their divorce, which was about to be made absolute, but to some of the consequences of that divorce. I had met Gillian in November, Terry having taken me with him when he went to collect a few belongings from the former marital home in Harrow. Tall, dark and slim, she was, as Terry had reported her to be, a nice person and obviously a good housekeeper. During the half hour we were there, she and Terry conversed amicably enough, and anyone observing them together would have thought they were a well-matched couple. But now, as March passed into April, there came from that quarter a succession of blows from which, perhaps, he never really recovered. The gist of the matter was that Gillian was planning to marry again, and that she and her husband-to-be would be moving to Cornwall, and that the latter had stipulated, as a condition of the marriage, that Fiona should live with them and be brought up as his daughter. Terry was shocked, hurt, angry. Unfortunately, he was quite unable to express his anger, even in a controlled way. To express anger and aggression was to invite violence. Here the butcher father of his boyhood cast a dark shadow, and of violence he was so afraid that any expression of anger, whether in speech or writing, was for him a psychological impossibility. Consequently, whenever he replied to a letter from Gillian or wrote to his solicitor, there was a severe conflict between what he felt like saying and his fear of actually saying it, so that his drafts and redrafts were a typist's nightmare of false starts, corrections and interlineations. Had he expressed himself too strongly? Could the same point not be made more moderately? Was a qualification needed? Sometimes this struggle would go on for hours, even days, leaving him feeling exhausted and depressed, and with nothing to show for his pains other than a stilted statement of his position that could have been written for him by someone with no personal interest in the matter, and which, dissatisfied with it, though he might be, he had no alternative but to sign and send. Much as I sympathised with Terry, there was little I could do to help, apart from offering advice and reassurance and typing his letters for him when he was too tired or too depressed to do so himself. Though I have no recollection of the precise content of these letters, I remember being left with the distinct impression that, strong as his position might be, morally speaking, legally it was quite weak. Whether out of old-fashioned gentlemanliness or naivety or a feeling of culpability, he had allowed himself to be cast in the role of the guilty party. After his separation from Gillian, her father had put two private detectives on his and Vivian's trail. And as the divorce laws then stood, this circumstance probably counted against him so far as custody of or access to Fiona was concerned. Be that as it may, one of the consequences of the divorce was that when, in the late spring or early summer, Gillian moved to Cornwall with her new husband, Fiona went with them, and Terry saw his little daughter no more.